Well, Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
Well, it's the first Sabbath of the month. I know we usually have a discussion week, but I decided to save that possibly for next week. As Sherilyn mentioned, I am leaving tomorrow, and I won't be back until late Friday afternoon, and I don't know how much time I'll have while I'm there to work on a message. So I thought, well, rather than have discussion week this week, I'll save it. If I can get a message put together, I will. If not, then I'll lean on that. All right. Well, this last week, I happened across this little Jewish joke. I thought it was kind of funny and appropriate for our section that we're on. We're going through these Jewish laws, right? And so, as you begin to look into Yehovah's word and start living the way that he outlines, I guarantee you will have that day, if you haven't had it already, where someone asks you, "Are you Jewish?" Well, it's happened to me many times, and that's maybe why I got a kick out of this story. But anyway, it says a woman was on a train and walked up to a man across the aisle at another table and said, "Excuse me, but are you Jewish?" And the guy says, "No." And she walked away, but a few minutes later she returned and she said, "Excuse me, sorry again, but are you sure you're not Jewish?" And he goes, "I'm really sure," said the man. So she walked away again, but she wasn't convinced. She came back a third time and she approached him and said, "Are you absolutely sure you're not Jewish?" And the guy just acquiesced. He says, all right, okay, I'm Jewish already. And she goes, "Well, that's funny. You don't look Jewish." So indeed, you can look Jewish without looking Jewish. Anyway, I got a kick out of it. I guess I'll have to leave my stand-up comedian vocation for another time. Oh well, enough of that. Let's get into the Word. Remember that as we go through this, don't forget to like jot your notes down, jot your whatever you get out of these things, because I'm certainly not going to find everything. Okay, so where were we? I'm going to try to get through the end of chapter 22 today. Maybe it'll give us some extra time, maybe it won't, I don't know. Depends on how fast we go. But we ended up last time at Exodus chapter 22 and verse 6. And so maybe up to this point you might have seen, and I wanted to bring this out before, this kind of if-then structure that he had going here for a while. That, you know, if this happens, then you are to do this, right? And so, well, let's just look at this. This is where we ended up last time, and you can kind of see that, right? That if a man causes a field, okay, then this is what's going to happen. The point is that there's going to be things that arise within the body of God's set apart people that they're going to have to deal with. And it's just part of everyday life and society, you know, things happen. So how do we deal with this? Well, this just begins to set up kind of a dynamic of action and consequence, right? Sowing and reaping. If you do this, then this is what will happen to you, right? And these are practical matters that are being dealt with. They aren't theoretical possibilities in many cases. And so the principles, you know, you can see a judgment, and you can see the judgment for being the judgment, or you can see the line of thinking, the character, the heart that led to that conclusion, and that can be applied to many other situations besides the situation that's being talked about. It's a lot like our Western society here, because that they did not, how should I put this? This wasn't a surprise to them that Yehovah had a law. They were expecting some sort of legal code for this new, whatever this is going to be. You would expect that. And these law codes that are given here are not, in many cases, certainly not all, in many cases, not unlike other laws that were in nations around them. So we see that today, right? I mean, the United States, for example, and Europe, most of North America and Europe have very similar sort of basic structure to the justice system. You know, you have experts that will represent somebody. Generally, you can't be physically harmed for trying to protect property. Neither Europe or North America sanctions mutilating the body in any way, that kind of punishment. So we see that even the death penalty is only applied in the most horrific cases. So yes, there's differences, I grant that, but there's some basic framework things that are kind of the same. So what constituted a crime was generally the same for Israel as it was in many of the other ancient Middle Eastern societies. And more often than not, the punishments even were similar. But God's law involved far more mercy and compassion, and you'll see that. You know, for example, where it was the norm in other societies to do physical harm to a thief, you know, we see that in some Muslim states now. You steal something, I don't know if it's a finger or a hand or what you lose, but, you know, you don't do it twice. So you could say, well, that's working, you know, to a degree. But this was not the way it was to be in Israel. So that was something that was different. So a lot of the differences came in how things were dealt with, right? Because many things are just morally wrong, you know, murder and stealing and a lot of these things. Okay. So we do get valuable insight on how Yehovah evaluates justice by looking at these if-then references and not looking just at the if-then situation, but what had to happen, or what train of thought brought about that judgment. Let's continue on, verse 7, and we're going to see some more of these if-then statements. If a man delivers to his neighbor money or articles to keep, and it is stolen out of the man's house. Okay. If the thief is found, he shall pay double. There's that restitution again that we saw. If the thief is not found, then now we're just trying to figure out who did it. Did the master do it or not? Or did somebody else do it? So the master's to be brought to the judges to see whether he has put his hand into his neighbor's goods. Did you do it? For any kind of trespass, whether it concerns an ox, anything, any kind of lost thing which another claims to be his, the cause of both parties shall come before the judges, and whoever the judges condemn shall pay double to his neighbor. So if you have something of someone else's and it's stolen while it's in your care, then, you know, if you didn't do it, you don't have a problem. And so if the thief is found, he's going to pay double, right? If not found, you know, if you can't find them, then it might be you. You know, you gotta figure out some way to prove that it's not you, I guess, or they have to prove that it is you. So, do they go to jail for 10 years? No. And so you begin to start to see some wisdom in how these things are put together. You can't argue with that kind of logic, can you? What we're trying to do is we're trying to find who really did it, what's the source, and make it right. Okay? That's the double. Well, you ought to be made whole, and you ought to have something for your trouble for all this mess, right? So it's justice. It's just, right? And so one of the things that occurred to me is as we read through most of these, we're going to see obvious wisdom. And we think, okay, that wisdom, and that's obvious. The benefits of it being followed, I can see that. And I can see how that works. But what about the parts of the Mishpat that are not as easy to see? And this is why I ask the question, do we have to be in agreement with God for Him to be right? It does not require our agreement for it to be right. It's right whether we believe it, whether we understand it, whether we've ever even heard it before. It exists as right. We're the ones that are many times apart from that. And so when right is presented to us, okay, we try to assimilate that. We try to, you know, make it our own, or we try to understand it, okay, to come in alignment with it. And in our world, we are so deluged with falsehood and deception that we're on this, okay, am I really going to believe that or not? We cannot do that with this. We have to see these. We have to see this as a body of things that God is saying. And as we read the things that are just, we go, yes, 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 yes. You know, of course, this makes sense. So that when we get to something that we go, wait a minute, I don't understand that. We don't look at it from a position of being critical of it. We look at it as, I don't understand that. It is right. Why don't I understand it? It's okay to say, I don't understand it. It's okay to question it. It's not okay to question its source and its validity. Okay. This situation here had everything to do with having something coming up missing while you have it. The next section addresses if something dies while you have it. The man delivers to his neighbor a donkey, an ox, a sheep, or any animal to keep, and it dies, is hurt or driven away, no one seeing it. Then an oath of the Lord shall be between them both. In other words, the man's got to swear, because, no, I didn't do it. Okay. And the other guy's got to believe him. Okay. And he doesn't have to make it good. But if, in fact, it was stolen from him, oh, yeah, he's got to make restitution, which is going to be double. It's going to apply the way it always did. If it's torn to pieces by a beast, then he shall bring it as evidence. That makes sense. Well, I'm saying I didn't do it. Well, I found it in the field. It's all, you know, here you go. Well, see, I didn't do it. And if a man borrows anything from his neighbor and it becomes injured or dies, the owner of it not being with it, he shall surely make it good. Okay? If its owner was with it, he shall not make it good. If it was hired, it came for its hire. So we have here some more of these if-then statements. And you really can study these and look at them and see how Yehovah reasons, how he has equity in the things that he does. This is very similar to the last part, right? So if it died while it's in your care and wasn't your fault, so be it. But if it was your fault, you've got to pay the restitution. That strikes a chord as being fair. Of course it does. I mean, I would follow this anyway. You see what I'm saying? We look at these things and we go, well, I would do this anyway. Well, I don't need a law for this. You know, if I borrow something from you, you can expect me to return it, number one. Number two, sometimes it's in better shape than when I borrowed it. It's cleaner, it's lubed, it's, you know, whatever, you know. It's more full of gas than it was when I borrowed it, you know, that kind of thing. As good or better than, so of course, that's what you do. And so, again, that's the easy ones that give you confidence in the ones that make you go, huh. This next one makes sense too. Verse 16 now. If a man entices a virgin who is not betrothed and lies with her, okay, he shall surely pay the bride price for her to be his wife. You got to remember back to how Hebrew wedding and betrothal works. If her father utterly refuses to give her to him, he shall pay money according to the bride price of virgins. There's a lot there. In there. I mean, you can look at this, right, and you can say, okay, all right, well, so you seduce someone, and, well, after a few, you know, you had a few too many glasses of wine, and you seduce this person, you thought she was maybe a strong 10, but in the morning light, she's maybe a weak 3, so you decide, no, never mind. Doesn't work that way. Not in God's way of doing things. You see, because that woman is valuable to God. And, you know, you couldn't use sex that way. You couldn't, you know, she's not a plaything. She's valuable. And you've taken something from her she cannot replace. You can't have your free sex. Our society doesn't like that. We have Supreme Court cases right now trying to protect our free sex in this country. She deserves the bride price. What if this was in place today? What if, I mean, you wouldn't be having all this premarital sex, you know, there'd be a lot less trips to Lookout Point if the guy knew, well, this is for real, this is forever if I do this, right? That's what he's saying. Can you just see the principle there? Because this is a good place to dig in to see how to do this. You could look at this as a static rule, but consider the implications. If a man seduces a woman and he has not pledged to marry her, what is that? Fornication. Premarital sex, right? And what does God say about that? He says right here, no. He shall surely pay the bride price for her to be his wife. His thing is, you go sleep with a woman, you're married. Ooh, what row? God considers them married at that point, so you must pay the bride price for her since she's now your bride, because that's what you wanted, right? You guys had sex. So spiritually, to God, this is the status. This is Yehovah's will. That's his best. that his children will become attracted to each other. They'll bond in that way, makes them married, they covenant together, and they're not to stray out of that marriage. That's his design. There is actually, I don't have time to go into it, but there is actually a bond that is created during sex. They've proven it. It's like there is a spiritual, like, aura type weird. I mean, nobody can tell you that the relationship doesn't completely change when that happens. It's only meant to be that one time. And so that's his design. But now, Yehovah's not ignorant of the opposition here. He knows the environment that we live in. What if the man forced himself on her? Okay. Well, if it's to the point of rape, that's dealt with elsewhere in the Mishpat, and it's a capital offense. He'd be stoned. But he'd pay the bride price first. She'd still be compensated if he had it to do it. Okay. So that's the father's best. That what you have sex with, well, the person that you choose, that's your mate, right? But some of the things that God addresses doesn't mean that he allows them or it's his best. It means that he's addressing a nation in a corrupt ancient world, and some of the things he needs to address because he just has to, because of the environment, right? Okay, so what does he say? He gives an out here, you know, and he allows the physical father to evaluate the situation. You know, what if it was an older man that took advantage of the immaturity of a younger woman, and the father deems that this was inappropriate? You know, there's a lot of gray area between full-on rape and what just happened here, okay? And so the father gives the physical, the spiritual father says, my best is they're married, but gives some power to the physical father to say, you know, you can judge, you know, these things. And so we saw kind of that same thing last week with the slavery, where God is addressing something that he really shouldn't have to address. Slavery was something that happened then, okay? But he made it very plain that you can buy a person's time, but you can't buy a person. You can't own a person. You can own their time. Okay, so it's very similar, like we talked about, with the situation that we have now and the way that we do things. So I just bring that out because I just want you to see that God sometimes in this Mishpat has to address things, and it doesn't mean that he condones them. Okay, all right, let's move on. We're going to encounter some more laws that have a completely different kind of structure. You know, we've been talking about these if-then things, but now we're going to see some things that no ifs, ands, or buts. These are things that should never happen within the family of God. In other words, they're so out of character and so egregious to the society that threat needs to be completely removed, obliterated, put to death. Okay, get it out. All right. So these are matters of morality and conscience rather than crimes of against other men, against a fellow man. And so what we're going to see is the previous laws took circumstances into account and intent when considering what, if any, consequence there would be to it, the punishment. But these next ones, maybe with except maybe the ones about loaning money. Intent and consequence, circumstance almost play no role. Looky here. Exodus 22:18. You shall not permit a sorceress to live. There's no if-then statement there. I suppose you could make it one. If you have a sorceress, then put her to death. But it's a simple statement. And what's this saying to us? No magic. No occult. None of that stuff of any kind is to occur among God's people. It's because it says, don't even permit it to exist within your gates. Kill it. I mean, that's as strong as you can get. A female sorcerer is to be exterminated. Males too, but it's just the way this was done. When we think of sorcery, it's invoking the names of gods or demons to try to do something for us, to serve us in some way. And since monotheism is the worship of one God, okay, one, we reject everything else. And so this is a very, very offensive thing to God. When He's the creator of the universe, He owns everything, He's made you, He supports your life, and you go to what else for help or to sacrifice to or what have you, okay? And so it was offensive. Was also dangerous because sorcery was virtually universal in ancient times. And so people were easily deceived and easily drawn in by these people. And the fact that magic, any of this kind of thing, was outlawed in Israel really set them apart. It was highly unique in the ancient world. So now you could, I guess, pass by this one and say, well, this isn't applicable to me. If I knew a sorceress, I couldn't go kill her because of the physical nation that I'm in. So I'm just going to move on. This one has nothing for me. No, it's not true. We've already stated it. You don't look outside the Father for spiritual guidance. Superstitions, horoscopes, tarot cards, Ouija boards, all that sort of stuff, it's strictly prohibited to the point of death. So Yehovah is serious about this. You can't skim by that. Don't dabble in the occult at all. There is one and only one spirit realm entity that you are to desire a relationship with, or to get answers from, or direction from, or advice from. Don't engage in anything else. Do not permit it to live in your life. Verse 19 says, whoever lies with an animal shall surely be put to death. Oh, this is the prohibition against bestiality. It's a horrible perversion of a human having sexual intercourse with an animal. But it was needed because it was widespread through the inhabitants of Canaan. Widespread. And if you think this is just some ancient thing, think again. I did a 2-minute small dive into, very carefully I might add, looking for reports and stuff.
Yes, Bennett. Okay.
Yeah. Michigan State University reports that upwards of 5% of men and 2% of women globally have engaged in some sort of bestiality. Another report said it was almost 8% and almost 4% of women. Guys, this is something that's right under the surface of our society right now, our current society. It's nasty. You know, we had homosexuality when I was growing up at just under the surface of the society. You didn't hear about it in polite society at all, but it was there. And now we have this, and it's just there. And so the next thing you know, they're going to want to come out of the closet and have rights like everyone else and have their perversion accepted, or we're racist. They'll want to marry the one that they're in love with, because after all, love is love. That's what we hear, right? In a culture that allows men to marry men and women to marry women because love is love, it's a short stone throw to love your pet too. If marriage isn't restricted to one man and one woman, what's it restricted to? Our leaders just can't seem to lead. They can't judge righteously. See, with these precedents set, and people have already talked about this, with these precedents set, the only thing that keeps that from happening, from people marrying Fido or whatever, is for the leaders to stand on moral ground, because they've lost the legal precedent. So how much confidence do you have in your leader standing on moral ground? I won't let you answer that. Next verse. He who sacrifices to any god except the Lord only, he shall be utterly destroyed. Okay. Well, now, wait a minute. Isn't he just rehashing this? We have the instruction to have no other gods before Yehovah. We have the command against idols. Now God is showing some application here, because sacrifice is at the heart of idolatry. To sacrifice on the altar of a heathen god is here proclaimed to incur the death penalty. What is interesting is the need for Yehovah that he seems to have to even say this. Why does he have to even say this? After it's already been made clear that, hey, you're not to worship. You're not to worship any other gods. Now get this. We're not to worship any other gods, but what about sacrificing? Aren't those, what's the difference? Well, there isn't any difference, is there? Unless you're trying to weasel out of something. Unless you want to justify and do what you want to do anyway. The reason the issue is discussed in this way is quite simple, because the Israelites were always looking for loopholes. Just they're no different than us. Loopholes and trying to figure out, well, how close to the edge can I get before I fall off, you know? They would worship to a pagan god and say, well, or sacrifice to a pagan god and say, well, I'm not worshiping. We have this in writing, by the way. There's ancient texts where they would, well, I'm not worshiping the god. I'm sacrificing. It's not the same thing. Because they liked their idolatry, they wanted to keep their idolatry, and they wanted to operate like the rest of the world around them. The Bible is loaded with example after example of Israel constantly failing and by falling back into idolatry over and over again. And then God would rise up a prophet, and he would come and tell them, and they would say, no, it's not worship, it's sacrifice, it's okay. Until the judgment came, and then they could look back and say, oh yeah, I guess it was. But they didn't ever remember the lesson, right? They just wanted to get right up to the edge. They would say, well, you know what? it's not worship, it's sacrifice. I worship the true God. That's where my heart is. It's all about the heart. Sound familiar? Okay. God labels it as idolatry, the Israelites paid dearly every time that they strayed from this, and thousands of Israelites died because they did not obey this. So yeah, they were just as good at justifying as we are, you know. And that's a wake-up call for us. We can never be justifying these mishpats. We have to be in the mindset of trying to figure out where the boundaries are, so not so that we can get as close to them as possible, so that we can stay away from them as much as possible. Because these things have the death penalty, people. And that's got to make you take notice of the principles in these very, very carefully. Because you it's not going to live in the kingdom. Moving on, though, because as quickly and matter-of-factly as that we're told that these acts must bring death, the next series, and the next verse we're going to get to, really starts to talk about, and we see more of God's compassion and mercy, especially on the most vulnerable in society. Exodus 22:21 now says, "You shall neither mistreat a stranger nor oppress him, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt." Israel is told that they are to welcome and respect the ger, G-E-R, which is Hebrew for strangers. It's translated to foreigners and Gentiles that come to live with them. So what this actually contemplates is a foreigner, a Gentile, becoming a member of Israel. This instruction will be built upon as we move forward, okay? Eventually, we're going to see very clearly how someone becomes a Hebrew and how they are to be considered within the nation at that point. Not higher, not lower, just now you're just like a natural born. And this concept is vital to Christianity because the spiritual manifestation of this instruction is basically how, you know, we can become part of spiritual Israel. Okay. "You shall not afflict any widow or fatherless child. If you afflict them in any way and they cry at all to me, I will surely hear their cry, and my wrath will become hot, and I will kill you with the sword. Your wives shall be widows and your children fatherless." Widows and orphans are to be treated kindly and with compassion. In fact, God emphatically states that he will become angry, greatly angry, with those who abuse or take advantage of helpless women and children, and with severe consequences. Would you agree with that? Of course. Of course this is righteous. Otherwise, the strong would overpower the weak. This whole survival of the fittest thing is not part of Yehovah's justice. Rather than prey upon the weak, in God's society, the strong serve the weak. James 1:27, "Pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father is this, to visit orphans and widows in their trouble, and to keep oneself unspotted from the world." So yeah, we are not only commanded not to afflict them, but we are commanded to serve them. Okay? Let's get back to Exodus here. "If you lend money to any of my people who are poor among you, you shall not be like a moneylender to him. You shall not charge him interest. If you ever take your neighbor's garment as a pledge, you shall return it to him before the sun goes down. For that it is his only covering, it is his garment for his skin. What will he sleep in? And it will be that when he cries to me, I will hear, for I am gracious. The loaning of money to a poor person is now considered here. And that poor person is to be treated with mercy, because the desperate can be easily exploited, can't they? No interest is to be charged. And if that person offers his cloak, which is basically his outer coat, as a security for the money, it must be given back to him before the evening so he isn't cold. It was called a salma, S-A-L-M-A-H. And it was their outer garment. It wasn't like a coat. It was more and more like a blanket, kind of. And it would be their blanket when they would sleep. And sometimes for the poorest of the poor, that might be their only possession. So it's very important. So what are we to take from this? Where's the principle? What are we doing here? So we're talking about not taking away the basic need that the person has as collateral for the repayment of a loan. You don't take away the basics of life from a helpless person because you can loan him money. Compassion is not optional to Yehovah. It's a major element of his character, and we are to take on that character. Compassion and mercy are integral and foundational in God's system. In fact, we are warned throughout the Bible that if we expect to be beneficiaries of that compassion, his forgiveness, his mercy, then we are to extend those same things to everyone around us, including, and maybe even more importantly, the weakest around. The other thing I wanted to cover here, by the way, very quickly, was notice that they were not to charge interest to those two other Hebrews. It doesn't say anything about lending outside of the society. It doesn't say. But it says within the Hebrew people, you are not to charge interest. Okay? And this is not to say that God's people had license to go out and, you know, just really put it over everybody else. It just meant that mercy is called for, especially within the family of God. Okay. So we have a responsibility to our community to serve the community with resources. Let's move on to 28. Put this one up by itself because I want to compare translations. I want to show you something. Yeah, there it is. First, if you have a King James Version, this probably says, "You shall not revile the gods." Whereas in the New King James, "You shall not revile God," big G, "nor curse a ruler of your people." The King James is, "You shall not revile the gods," small g, "nor curse the ruler of thy people." The word here for gods is Elohim, and it can mean gods, little g, God, like in the plural of the King James, how they have it. It can mean that, but it's so far out of context, they shouldn't have done it that way. Obviously, later the later versions were corrected, because what you have to understand, there's, when you look at El, Oim, you've got the El, E-L, which can make what comes after it plural. That's true. Oim is God, so we have, you can see how they would say, well, you know, gods, because the Oim had the L in front of it. Okay. But there's another form of the word Elohim, and it's called the plural of majesty. So when you think about El being plural, okay, yeah, it's plural, but plural again, it's not English, you gotta think Hebrew. If I had, basketballs, and by the way, I have a 5-acre lot. If I filled the whole place with basketballs, that would be pretty grand, majestic amount of basketballs. Dumb analogy, you're getting where I'm going, okay? So that's what El can mean, is majesty, greatness, bigness. Rather than count, a lot of count in terms of multiples and plural, okay? It has this bigger overarching meaning of a lot, grand, majestic, everything. And so that is how you get El Elohim, because he is a great, majestic, wow, we don't have words, God. See what I mean? Okay, so it's El Elohim, big God, big gracious, big majestic God, not a bunch of little gods. Okay. I just wanted to make sure, people look at different versions, and I just wanted to make sure I covered this when I got here. All right, it goes on to say that we're not to curse gods. And in this text it says, both says revile. But then it goes on and says, or curse the ruler. Okay, so these two words, they're actually different, right? So I had it in my notes. I thought I put it in there what these words were. Maybe I didn't. Yeah, it is. Yeah, I did. It's qualal. And you might remember that word when we were talking about you honoring your parents. You can't curse, you couldn't curse your parents. Same word. So that's that qualal that we're talking about. That you shall not qualal God. And so what did we learn there? That it had to do with being an ingrate, not bringing dishonor onto your parents, right? Okay, and that's what he's saying here. We're not to do that with God. We're not to walk in a way that reviles, that brings dishonor to God. Okay, and it's different than this word, which is arar, A-R-A-R, which literally means very close to what we think of as curse. Okay? That is, no one is to swear a curse against their leader, either in the sense of making, something magical, or simply wishing evil or harm on them, or swearing at them in anger or bitterness. So in modern English, this verse basically says, first, not to bring disrepute upon the Lord by our bad behavior, and next, not to put a curse on your leader. That second part I'm being tested on every day, because I really want to cheer for Brandon. You don't get that reference, don't worry about it. Okay. The last part of chapter 22 deals with, tithes and offerings. Verse 29, you shall not delay to offer the first of your ripe produce and your juices. The firstborn of your sons you shall give to me. Likewise you shall do with your oxen and your sheep. It shall be with its mother 7 days, and on the eighth day you shall give it to me. I've addressed tithes and offerings before, and I'm always hesitant to even talk about it. But I will remind you of a few principles. Israel at this point was a physical nation. Any nation needs resources for national defense, for law enforcement, for services, you know, that need to be done for society. You know, somebody's got to sit on the wall, right? Those type of things. So in Israel, Yehovah set aside the priests, the Levite priests, to basically operate the nation. They had all the duties to do. And so because of that, they didn't get land. They got the provision that came through the tithes so that they could work and do the functioning of the nation. Now, it's an interesting nation because they were doing all these things, and God was doing a lot of the heavy lifting, right? He was providing all the militaries, you know, they didn't need defense, they didn't, you know, all these things. Okay, so in God's economy, the whole nation operated on this 10%. It was fantastic. 10% of the GNP was all it took, the gross national product. Today, we don't have a physical nation like that, do we? We don't tithe into our government. We pay taxes to fund those things. Unfortunately, they're not nearly as efficient as our Father in Heaven. So they get a lot more than 10%, don't they? And they do a lot less with it. They still can't get it done. We go in more debt. So as members of this nation, we pay our tithes, so to speak, don't we? But we're also members of a spiritual nation. And I think we've got to get that vision, okay? Because it has needs, right, to do its work. So the principle of tithing and offering is the same. The nation needs resources to function. Now, we're members of this nation, physical, it's where we live, we're forced to do it, okay? But we volunteer. Do we or do we not want to be in the kingdom of God? And so, while the principle of tithing is the same, that the nation needs money to function, the cool thing is, as members of spiritual Israel, we decide that we want to be in that kingdom. And so, the principle is we are to give. I don't give my taxes. I pay it begrudgingly with a frown on my face and hacked off that I have to do it. Okay? But joyfully. Why joyfully? Malachi 3 says to bring all the tithes into the storehouse that there may be food in my house, and try me, now test me, if I'll not open for you the windows of heaven and pour out for you such blessing that there will not be room enough to receive it. This is why I don't talk about it much. Because I don't want to take that blessing away by me standing here and saying, you, it is in God's law, you gotta do it. And make it the same thing as what I, no! You completely miss the blessing. Do you want to be in the kingdom? Really? Then sow into it cheerfully. This is my future. This is, you know what I'm saying? Sometimes, you know, the blessing comes after you begrudgingly start because you just obey. But it doesn't take long. I've got story after story. You probably, people in this room do too. Now 100 minus 10 equals 150 in God's economy. It's just the way it is. And so there's a lot of pastors, a lot of people that have problems addressing this subject. I don't have a problem addressing it. I have I don't have the same problem, I'll put it that way. Because they can be viewed as just, well, he's asking for money now, you know. Pastor's needing a new truck, you know, or a new airplane, you know. But that's not the case here. So I can stand here and tell you and assure you I'm not addressing this selfishly at all. Because at this point, this congregation isn't big enough to compensate anybody. You know, I don't get a dime. She doesn't get a dime. Nobody gets a dime for doing anything that we do to service each other in this congregation. We use the tithes to support being able to do services. The streaming box is owned by the church. I can't think of too many other things. I think this is. We don't have a lot of things that we have because we do it here at the house. So most of it goes to supporting other Sabbatarian ministries for their outreach parts, because we're not doing a lot of that yet. So put things there. We support the widows and the fatherless through Family Promise. And we pay for some expenses related to keeping the holy days. But other than that, listen, guys, this is a flow through. And look, I can't say I couldn't care less whether you tithe. I'm just saying the only reason that I care is because I don't want you to miss the blessing. And because I don't want you to miss the blessing, I don't want to stand here and yell at you and tell you you got to do it. So it's kind of a fine line. But if you have a problem with tithing, get this picture. For 10% of their increase, Israel got their government paid for, got their military paid for, got all their everything ran on that 10%. And they got God as their protector. He set a hedge of protection around that nation. And we're saying, God is inviting us into that kingdom, and he's saying, yeah, come in, and I'm going to set that same thing over you. You participate in my kingdom, I'm going to come. You see? Right? And so what a bargain. I started thinking about, okay, for 10%, I get God as a hedge of protection, blessing, covering everything that I own, making everything last longer, keeping people from coming and getting it. Who knows how many legions of angels people have seen who were trying to maybe come across this yard to do something nefarious in this house. You can't buy that. That kind of protection. I started thinking, you know, I think I spend 10% of my income on medical insurance, house insurance, car insurance, liability insurance, business insurance. I'm insuranced out the wazoo. I bet you it is. I'm paying a tithe to the insurance company. So 10%? I mean, that is the easiest, most joyful investment and place I can put my money. There isn't any other place to put it that's as good. The return. Now, it takes a little faith, I guess. It's not really faith. It's just trust in who said it. And that's what was my point earlier, is every time you look at these things, and yeah, this is wisdom, you get to the one that makes you go like this. Don't go like this. Trust the one that said it. Yehovah just lays it out and says, look at who I am. Look at what I do for my people. Do you want to be in my kingdom? Yeah. Okay. Start living in the kingdom. Sow into the kingdom. It's the easiest thing in the world to do. Let's head back here and we'll try to get finished up here real quick. I guess it didn't make it any shorter. Exodus 22, you shall not delay to offer the first of your ripe produce and your juices, the firstborn of your sons you shall give to me. Did we read that one already? Bottom line is, don't delay, right? Get it in there as quick as possible. It's like, you know, the best investment ever. Don't wait. Put it in there. get it working. Anyway, we're not to hold back to our benefit. You know, don't borrow money. All right, verse 31 here. Okay, yeah, this is the one. And you shall be holy men to me. You shall not eat meat torn by beasts in the field. You shall throw it to the dogs. That's an easy one, you know. You would think it would be easy, but what if you saw the coyote take the deer down? You just watched it happen. And you chase the deer off. Because you think, about if you find something torn by beasts, don't eat it. Well, that makes sense, because immediately it starts, you know, getting worms and everything, and you think, well, that makes a lot of sense. But now what if you just saw it happen? What if the deer's still warm, it's still bleeding out? See how we justify things? So what do you do? Isn't it just as easy just to not eat it? Just because of the one that said it? Isn't it enough that it's embedded in and surrounded by perfect wisdom? Wouldn't we think that's perfect wisdom too? Okay, I guess I'll have to skip that part. Anyway, I think we're going to stop here. I just hope that you see that God has that He has taken Israel and He has separated them from the rest of the earth. And much of this stuff is showing us where societies around are failing and what needs to be fixed. God values animals, but He doesn't value them higher than people. And He values animals more than things. You can kind of see that in what He's covered so far. So, anyway, the chapter break means nothing. We just continue on with kind of the same thing in chapter 23, but it does give us a good stopping point for today. So let's go ahead and huddle up and talk about it. All right? Everybody online, again, you're always invited to join us.